Hello, Paul. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the first episode of The Interviews in a little while. But we're back with a belter. Nimrod's A Green Day Comedy is a comedy that has Green Day, one of the biggest rock bands in the world, of course, in it, as opposed to being a comedy about Green Day. Specifically, it's about three friends who embark on a cross-country road trip to LA in the mistaken belief that Green Day have invited them to open for them at a New Year's Eve gig. Written and directed by Lee Kirk, it's a really bittersweet, funny, and surprisingly tender teen comedy with some great music, largely courtesy of Green Day themselves, who also cameo. But they are not the stars. The stars are the likes of McKenna Grace and Kyler Kaufman and Mason Thames. Yes, I finally learned how to correctly pronounce his name, and it's not Like the River, who anchors things wonderfully as the lead character, Tommy. I spoke to Kirk and Thames a few weeks ago at Comic-Con in San Diego. Mason, who you'll know, of course, from The Black Phone and the live-action How to Train Your Dragon, was absent for the first 10 minutes or so. But with a tight Comic-Con schedule looming for everyone, Lee Kirk and I pressed on, and you'll hear the moment when Mason turns up. It's really rather lovely. Anyway, talking to these guys about movies and music and more was a blast. Enjoy.
Lee Kirk, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great, man. Thanks for having me. This is really exciting.
This is very, very exciting. We're in San Diego at the moment. We're not in Comic-Con itself. That's over there. Petco Park is that way.
Yep.
I imagine you just got into town. Have you had a Comic-Con experience yet?
So far, well, I got in town last night and saw the chaos. There's people everywhere. I had never been here before, so it's pretty crazy. And went and saw Billy Joe played his band, The Cover-Ups, played a show last night. So went to see that show.
That's very nice.
That was a blast. Good times.
How many times have you seen Billy Joe play either with Green Day or The Cover-Ups now over the years?
Yeah, probably over the years. Eight to ten times.
Does it get boring? Do you think I'm over this now?
You know what? They're the best live band I've ever seen. They just bring it every night. So no, I haven't been bored yet.
That's good. Listen, I don't want to spoil things for Nimrod, but I think it's in the trailer. We can talk about this. Green Day. There's a Green Day performance.
Yes.
In the film, which I really liked as well because it sounded to me like you were capturing their sound live.
Yeah, we were. Yeah, which the whole thing was live.
Which is great.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm allergic to overdubbing and lip syncing.
I am as well. I don't think Green Day would have had it any other way.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have either. And that was actually one of the first things when Billy Joe and I talked about making the film. We talked about ending it with a big concert at the Hollywood Palladium.
Yeah.
And we would actually put on a concert. So what we did was we got 2,000 Green Day fans in there. And we just put on a show, of course, stopping and starting and doing it over and over again because we had a bunch of story to tell within the concert.
Yeah.
But it was electric and it was really cool because these are real Green Day fans. So it has that authenticity of a real Green Day concert because they're all singing along and they're all going nuts. And, it was fun. It was a blast.
How long was the concert? How many songs did they play?
I think they played probably a total of maybe 8 songs.
Okay.
Some for the film, some that I had put into the movie. And then just between takes, they'd be like, we're going to play a song for you. And they just crush, Revolution Radio or something like that. So it was really cool. The fans were excited.
Take me back to the beginning. How did this happen?
So originally Billy Joe reached out and said, hey man, I've always wanted to do a Green Day movie. Mm-hmm. And Billy Joe and I worked on a previous film together, Ordinary World. So, so he thought of me when the idea came to him to do a movie. And he said, I don't know what the movie is, but it ends with a New Year's Eve concert for Green Day at the Palladium. Okay. So we started talking about what it could be. And we came up with this idea of these kids in a band who are, traveling across the country to get to the Hollywood Palladium in a Green Day concert.
Yeah.
And from there, then, I realized as the writer of the script, I needed stories. I needed some really fun, crazy stuff to happen to these kids along the way. And I started quizzing Mike and Trey and Billy Joe about just stuff that happened to them and their years of driving around in a van, to get fun stories. And then I would take those sort of nuggets of a story and I'd sort of twist them in my own fictional way and put them into the story.
Okay.
And that extended beyond just the antics, to just details of just Green Day's, story.
The dynamics, the interpersonal relationships.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, like the bookmobile, for example, is now, it's an ice cream truck in the film, but that the ice cream truck has its DNA in the bookmobile. So it's lots of that. I would say the way I like to say it is that Green Day's fingerprints are all over this story. Yeah,
did they have fall-ins out? Because there are, you know, there's the central three in the movie. Yep. Let's just say they don't always get on. There are moments of schism.
Of course.
I think it's fair to say.
I think with any band, I'm sure there's moments when you're driving around, you know, for hours and dealing with life hardships.
I can't stand this person anymore.
you just stop talking right now.
Yeah.
You know, so while I didn't get into any specifics with that, with those guys, that's all just, I feel like it's inherent.
Yes.
You know, in the journey.
Yeah, because it's not, and this is very, very important, because Green Day are in it as themselves, so it can't be. But it's not a Green Day biopic, and that was on the table from the off.
Yeah, we didn't want to do a biopic, you know. But there is there's elements of them in it, you know. But it's not the three main characters aren't Mike and Trey and Billy Joe, you know.
Yeah.
But the essence of who Green Day is and what they do and what they stand for is in the film. Yeah.
Another thing that's really struck me about the film was that it's R-rated. Mm-hmm. It's properly R-rated. There were something like 4 F-bombs in the first 2 minutes. I went, oh, this is an R-rated film.
Okay. Yeah. It felt odd to make a PG Green Day movie, you know what
precisely.
I mean?
Precisely.
Yeah.
There's drug use. There's things they got in the movie. So it's not sanitized in that way. Was that something that was important to you and also to the guys?
Yeah, we never really discussed it, but it felt to me like if you had a movie, it had a Green Day movie, and it said PG, it just felt like maybe you weren't going there, you know. Yeah. So I wasn't putting the F-bombs in because it had to be an R-rated movie. It just felt
that's how the characters speak.
Yes, it felt authentic to the characters and how they would talk to each other. So, and that was, you know, authenticity was a guiding principle for me on this whole movie, was making this world feel real, making these characters feel real, making the music feel real.
Yeah.
That was all very important in the story for me.
Even down to the way you shoot the movie. Can you talk me through how you, the visual palette of the film and how you came upon that?
Yeah.
It seems like there's almost it feels very intimate. It feels very, you know, I don't know if you shot in film, but it feels that way.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk me through how you staged it?
Well, I had a great DP, David Robert Jones, who I work closely with. And, you know, I told him from the very beginning, I want a film that feels rough around the edges because this is a story that's rough around the edges and punk rock is rough around the edges. But I also want it to be beautiful to look at. I want beautiful images in there as well, you know. And man, he nailed it. He did such an amazing job. And one of the beautiful things is we shot in February in Oklahoma.
Okay.
So the sun is always low in the sky. So it just allows you to just frame up beautiful shots because you're not dealing with harsh shadows of the sun above, you know?
Yeah.
So that really helped. And he used, we did not shoot on film, but he used lenses from the 1950s, really helped give it that texture.
Because it does, it feels in a way that a lot of it was shot at magic hour. But I guess it does. Oklahoma in February, every hour is magic hour.
pretty much, man. Yeah. You have less light to work with, but the light is really, really perfect and you know, beautiful. So
that's awesome. So Mason's still, he's not here yet.
Not here.
It's very rock and roll, very late entrance.
Exactly, man. Hey, it's early. Okay. This is a teenage kid. It's like 9:30 right now. So who knows when he's going to roll in here.
What was it like working with him on set where you're like constantly going, Mason, get out of your trailer.
That kid's a pro. I'll tell you what, he showed up every day on time and prepared with really interesting choices, really great ideas, you know. Put his heart into it, but also very flexible. You know, if I needed to tweak something, he was there to do it, you know. Also the singing in the movie, you know, he sang and he did an amazing job singing. He just brought everything I wanted in that character. I wanted a character who you felt like when you watched him, like he was going to somehow figure it out, you know, like you believe in him. And I remember growing up, those kinds of movies, those kinds of characters in movies, I always responded to.
Yeah.
I'm talking about like Ferris Bueller, for example,
yeah.
right? Or the Goonies, Mikey, the lead kid.
Yes.
These are movies I was thinking about as I was writing the film. And you just believe that somehow this kid is going to take you on a journey that's going to work out somehow, you know? And Mason brought that quality to the character in a really nice way. And here he is now.
Oh my God. Good to see you, man. Good to see you. How are you doing?
Great, man.
Good. How are you? I'm so excited.
It's going to be awesome, man.
I'm so excited.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, bud. Good to see you again, man. You all right?
I'm good.
Good. You guys are on the podcast right now.
Yeah, this is happening. This is happening right now.
This is what
it is. Chris. Nice to see you.
Hey, how are you?
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. Likewise.
Sit there, you go, can. Buddy.
Okay.
Hold the microphone just
it's
under
good
the.
Good to see you.
It's so good. Buddy.
Yeah. There's your microphone there, Mason. If you can just hold it, maybe hand up a little bit. Yeah, I don't want to say hand up the shaft a little bit.
Like, right,
yes, perfect. Thank you.
Okay, amazing.
It's far too early for me to be saying hand up the shaft a little bit. but there you go.
Hey, man,
a couple more coffees.
This is a punk rock movie. Let's go. couple more
this is on brand. We're all
right. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Go for it.
So, Mason, where have you been?
dude, where have I not been? I was in Hong Kong and Budapest for a bit doing a job.
Okay.
And then I got done with that, and now I'm just excited because I get to promote these movies that, you know, I'm very excited and just passionate about, and I think everybody a part of it is. So it's gonna be fun. It's gonna be really, really fun.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, man.
All right, but that doesn't answer the question of where you were this morning. Why are you late?
Oh, this morning. Yes,
what's happening?
I was in my hotel room, and I was told to come down at this time. I may have gotten false information, but listen, I am here at the right time. Okay.
Listen, if you want to throw anyone under the bus, now is the time.
All right. So, first of all, it's all Louis' fault. Blame Green Day.
Exactly.
Everybody's at fault except me.
What were the first conversations you both had as actor and director about this movie and this character?
Well, you know, first of all, I just thought as Mason, he has an essence to him, as you are seeing now. He's just a great kid, a really wonderful kid, and very accessible. And that is in Tommy right there, you know. So I knew Mason would bring that already to the character. And then he gave him a certain edges, certain colors, you know, that just part of, you know, Mason's creativity, you know, and then, you know, we rehearsed, like he said, we rehearsed the band. And I think the rehearsing also kind of like brought out a little bit of a swagger in Tommy, right?
Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Like he's a guy who's got a dream and he doesn't really want to take no for an answer. Mm-hmm. He just pursues that dream. Is something you could relate to in your career? Is it something that you've really pursued in that same sort of dogged enthusiasm?
100%. I mean, just starting off, I always knew I wanted, you know, something. And I started off in ballet, and performing up on stage was the light that I've always kind of been drawn to. And it wasn't ballet. And I got into acting, and it was kind of a thing where it was what I wanted. I wasn't going to stop. And it was, I moved out to LA when I was maybe 10, and it's about four years of just three auditions a day going back and forth from Burbank to Santa Monica. And I think a lot of people know how this is, but it was just nose, nose, nose. And it was a thing where it was costing me and my family just a lot. And nobody kind of knew if it was going to work out, but no matter what, I didn't want to stop. And I still never want to. This is something that I would like to see myself in for the rest of my life, even if it's not in front of the screen, but behind the screen. It's just filmmaking in general is something that I'm so passionate about. And Tommy, music is his everything. It's his therapy. It's his, he can, you know, take out his rage. He can, you know, show love. It's everything he needs it to be. And I think a lot of people can understand that. And it's him striving not for greatness or anything like that. It's just, it's all he knows. And it's kind of like what I said, it's all or nothing. So, I think I can relate to Tommy on a lot of different levels.
I mean, have either of you had to, not necessarily lie to get ahead in your career, but maybe, you know, obfuscate the truth now and again.
Tell something.
Precisely.
I think that goes with the territory.
Yeah, or skirt past a security guard to get to an audition or something like that.
I knew how to play guitar. Imagine.
Okay. Yeah. And the truth was?
I did not know. I was like, sorry. but I mean, I was doing a job, and I was like in the middle of a winter camp, in the middle of nowhere. And I just kind of...
So that'd be the black phone too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I just had to try to learn what I can, but it got to a point where it was a lot of the songs are really difficult. So it was just watching other people, and a lot of one of our bandmates, Kyler, he... Yeah. He knew how to play instruments, and he'd been in a band, and a lot of people part of our group were and have been and still are. And it was just kind of a thing. We're watching them and trying to make it look as authentic as possible. And obviously a giant help from Lee and all of that, because it was a lot to take on and just try to look like.
Oh, and he did,
all
man.
These guys looked like they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, but. You pulled it off, man. You pulled it off. It was really special.
Okay.
You are an actor. I am an actor. Yes, you okay. are.
So if I were to produce a guitar right now, don't worry, I don't have one. I'm not magic. But what could you do? How many, is it three chords in the truth?
I can play any song. No. I've been working a good bit, so I haven't had time to keep it up as much as I wish I could. But I'm on a little bit of break now off these jobs, so I have a couple guitars at home that I'm gonna hook back up. And McKenna obviously knows how to play, so yeah. She's gonna help me out with that. So.
Amazing,
that's amazing, dude.
So you playing Green Day stuff? Because Lee said you're a Green Day fan.
Oh, 100%. I mean, McKenna, she tried to teach me, because before production, I obviously didn't know how, and she would send me these videos of her literally making like a YouTube how to play guitar like tutorial, mm-hmm. and like show me all the easy things. So it was a lot of help, but she knows all the songs, so she helps me out with them. But I try my best.
That's amazing, dude. I love it. I remember when she was sending you stuff, and you were like, "You send me videos of playing the guitar," and I was like, "It's happening! It's happening!
It's happening slowly,
yes, slowly, it's happening."
Moving your fingers into position.
Yeah, yeah. We're just gonna pan up from that. I think.
There was a lot of things in the movie. It's like, oh, go back up.
A third hand comes in from the stunt guitarist. He's just like, out of sight.
My hands are behind my back. You're just a person below me playing like that.
It's not a bad idea, I tell you. I've got to let you guys go in a second, but let's talk about Green Day. I mean, Lee, obviously you and the guys go way back, but shooting scenes with Green Day and, Mason, you have scenes, more scenes, I say, with Billy Joe as mm-hmm. well. What was that like for you both? I'll start with you, Mason, and then Lee.
He just has this like aura to him. It's so cool. And I remember Lee took me to a Green Day concert before filming. And by the way, that was my kind of like my first concert ever. And I remember going backstage and Billy just like pops out and he was just there. And like, you see these videos of him up on stage, and I mean, he's a monster. He's an animal. I mean, he can perform like that for hours and hours. And I don't know what I was expecting, but he walks up and he's just the chillest dude I think I've ever seen. He was just... I was just like, "Hey, I'm such a big." And he's just like, "Hey, man, yeah, it's nice to meet you. Are you excited for the show?" I'm like, "Yeah." And it was like, "Well, let me know how it is afterwards." I was like, "Wow, that was really cool." And my experience with him ever since then has been just—he's such a down-to-earth, humble, cool, chill person.
Yeah,
and really fun to talk to. And I mean, obviously, my characters. Pretty based off of Billy. I mean, that's how I went into it, was basing a good amount of stuff off of Billy, and getting to talk with him, even if it's for a short bit, was really nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love him. I love all of them.
Amazing. And Lee, do you get to, as a director of Green Day, do you get to get right in their faces and yell at them, going, "That last take was rubbish.
Yeah, that was better next time. Take it again. Remember your lines,
tomato,
guys.
Tomato.
Come here, Armstrong." I'm old school.
You know what? What was wonderful about this is these guys, they're Green Day. They have their thing, And it was sort of like just point and shoot. Here we go.
Basically.
Guys, do your thing, And so we have that scene in the record store, which was just a blast to shoot. So and they just, they were just doing their thing. Of course, they've done that a million times, sat behind a table and signed people's stuff.
Yeah.
So it was like, have fun, guys. And they had lines and they did their lines, but they also improvised and did their own thing. And which was what I wanted, by the way, and then, of course, the concert was a complete blast. And we had that nice scene with Bobby Lee, which was really
fun. I love that one.
so with Billy Joe as well, and it was just a blast. You know, it was great. Those guys are great. Billy Joe's phenomenal, and I'd worked with him before, Mason's right. He has just an essence about him. I mean, he's an artist. The guy's just an artist, you know, and he just, he's, something comes through of him, you know, in a big way on a stage, but also just when you frame up the camera and just point it at him. So it was cool.
Amazing. Gotta let you guys go, but we're at Comic-Con. I know you haven't really had a chance to properly walk around the convention center yet, but have you seen, I mean, Mason, have you seen any grabbers?
not yet, but I'll be looking out for them when I see them all around.
I was going to say, so. you might just see grabbers wherever you go, right? It's just this.
Yeah, a lot of grabbers. Every time I close my eyes. Yeah,
that guy's a grabber. You can see him too, right? No,
wait, no, it's just take me. It easy, Mason. You're all right.
I'm safe here.
Brilliant. On that note, guys, I hope you had the time of your life. Thanks so much.
There we go.
I
know.
Yes. There we go.
Welcome to paradise, guys. Okay.
And I smack it out of the park. Amazing. Mason Lee, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Yeah.
Cheers, guys.
Okay, that was Mason Thames and Lee Kirk, star and director, respectively, of Nimrods, a Green Day comedy, and that film is in cinemas right now. As is Adam Shankman's riotous spoof comedy, Stop That Train, which is an old-fashioned throwback to the spoofs of Sucker Abraham Sucker, the likes of Airplane and Top Secret and The Naked Gun, but with a RuPaul's Drag Race twist. It was, in fact, produced by RuPaul, who also plays a president, and it sees Ginger Minj and Jujubee on a runaway train packed with cannon fodder, celebrities, and celebrity cannon fodder. It's something of a departure for Shankman, a choreographer turned director who has films like The Wedding Planner, Rock of Ages, Hairspray, the musical version, and The Pacifier under his belt, but he handles it admirably. And in this interview, he talks about the film's unusual journey to the screen, how he feels about directing, his unique relationship with Sarah Michelle Gellar, who cameos in the film, and the correct way to say the film's title. Enjoy. Before we talk about Stop That Train, that's how I'm saying it, Adam. Is that correct? Or am I pronouncing it wrong?
You pronounced it exactly right. That's literally the exact pronunciation. You got an A+ on that one.
The emphasis is in all the right words in all the right places. That's good. Yeah. This is obviously an audio podcast, but I am very taken, sir, with the wall behind you, which is liberally festooned with incredible pictures from where? From throughout your career or just stuff that you like?
Yeah, it's career, family, and friends. It's my life. It's just like a gallery wall of my life. It's like, it's all special moments and, you know, people who've meant a great deal to me and, amazing. I don't know.
No, it's good. It's good.
It's the wall of tears.
The wall. So does that mean that you like to look at it and then tear up every now and again, or do you like to avoid looking at it?
My misspent youth, my misbegotten life, my, you know, triumphs and losses, the whole spectrum.
Is there anything on there from Stop That Train?
Let me see. Is there? No, but I just had something printed. I did just have something printed that I would like to put up there. Yes.
Okay. Excellent. Because I imagine this is like it was a 19-day shoot. An absolute, I don't know, just hell for leather, pushed to the finish line.
Mayhem. It was mayhem, dude. It was, I'm not going to lie. It was mayhem. But it was sweet chaos.
Yeah. It taught me through the sweet chaos. How did it begin? And then did it ease as time went on?
When they asked me to do it, I had taken, I was about to embark on the other movie I have coming out this year, which is Man with the Bag, the Christmas movie. And I was like, and there's so little time in between seasons of Drag Race where Rue was available, where RuPaul was available. And we were just trying to, and I read the script and I thought it was absolutely hilarious. And it was so stupid and so silly and such a delight that I was just like, I want to make it. Like, you don't get the opportunity to make movies like this anymore, or they just don't come across my desk. And I was honored and thrilled at the opportunity. And I said, but I understood how limited the resources were and the time constraints. And I said, I think we can do it. And so it was a legitimate labor of love, and it was a blast. And but I mean, I only had like 3 weeks, you know, to get it ready. I mean, 2 weeks after I finished Man with the Bag, I was shooting. I was in the Oval Office. We were shooting that scene two weeks later. So, and then we had kind of a little break there where they were trying to build the train in time. And like that train, do not lean up against the walls because they're fucking paper mache, man. They're like that shit, you're going to fall through and it looks great, but like don't put too much pressure on there because you can see in the outtakes, like I'm like trying to show Natasha Leggero and I almost go through a window. Like it's like it was everything was just spitting glue.
When was the last time that you made a movie that was held together by spitting sellotape?
Never. I mean, it was like, even my short film was like, we were in actual locations. So it was like, I've never done it before. And, but I had this feeling that everybody was so game and understood the assignment. I mean, I made sure everybody understood the assignment before we started, like, but they understood it in such a way and was so supportive of putting these particular artists, these drag queens, front and center, and wanted to do it so much that I was like, I'm pretty sure we can just get it done. I mean, some days were like, uh-oh, but you know, it was wild, you know.
I just had the pleasure of talking to Ginger Minge and Jujubee before this podcast as well. And they were talking about how, you know, they essentially have to play it straight and they're in a different film from everyone else. In terms of understanding the assignment, how did you convey to them the tone that they were going for? And how did you convey to everyone else, all the day players, for example, all the big name day players you have coming in?
The first thing I said to everybody is, you're in a drama, period, end of story. You are in a drama, no matter what. Like, do not ever play the joke. Do not ever play the comic. Like, you just, the stakes for all of your characters have to be incredibly real. It needs to bump up to like a soap operatic level of drama. Like, we can't play it, you know, quiet and serious, like in that way. But we have to, you know, play the quote unquote absurd, the calamity of what's going on. But all of these things have to feel incredibly real to you. And so, so they did, you know, and that, because that to me is the only way that a satire like this plays. You know, this is in a long tradition. It's not just the airplanes and Top Secrets and Naked Guns and Hot Shots. It's also the Mel Brooks movie, the High Anxiety, Blazing Saddles, whatever, the early Mel Brooks stuff. Like, but Young Frankenstein, I mean, everything has to be real to these people. And so once they heard that and knew that that's what I expected, then everything kind of fell into place.
On this podcast, we're huge fans of a lot of those parody movies that you talked about, you know, Mel Brooks and the Sucker Abraham Sucker movies. I'm constantly talking about how Top Secret is possibly the funniest movie ever made on our podcast.
This has come up repeatedly. I love that because Top Secret feels like such a lost gem to me. Like, you know, it is like, there's like no young person who knows about Top Secret and you have, or you have to be a true cinephile to like, you know, and particularly a lover of comedy to have discovered Top Secret. Yeah, I love Top Secret.
So were you asking cast members to kind of sit down and watch these movies in a way?
Yeah, I asked them if they didn't have a familiarity with them. I was like, I think it's important just so you understand the tone. Like, you should look at these things so that you understand. These are all just words coming out of me, but if you see it visually, I think you'll understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah, very much so. And I don't want to spoil every cameo that's in this, because if I started listing all the people who are in this, Adam, frankly, I'd run out of time very, very quickly.
They're on the poster.
A lot of them are on the poster. And in fairness, they're in the first 30 seconds of the movie. All the names are there in the first 30 seconds of the movie. True. So, but you have, I mean, it's an amazing, amazing lineup of comedic talent just popping in sometimes for just one gag, two gags, and then they're gone.
Online sometimes, yeah. Like it was, you know, I can tell you, like, the both Paul Scheer and Joel McHale got calls like the day before. Like I had decided that I was like, no, I need two more bits in the opening thing where we are, because I was concerned. I was like, look, that right now it's like in the setup of the movie, it's almost all drag queens. There's no jokes from any of the cameos. And so I would like an audience to not be led to believe that it's only going to be drag queens in the movie. And so let's put some cameos in that opening commercial. And, but that didn't happen until the day before we shot it. And we were already shooting the movie. Like that wasn't in the script. And so Connor and Christina wrote up a bunch of gags and I was like, I like this one. I like this one. And we got on the phone and I called Joel and Randy Barbato called Paul. And like, we were like, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? I mean, it was like that. Do you have, you know, and well, Joel was like, well, how long? And I was like, Joel, I swear to God, you're going to be in and out in under an hour. He was like, are you fucking serious? And I was like, I'm not kidding. He was like, I know how this works. It's not, I was like, I'm telling you, you're going to be in and out in under an hour. And he was. So, you know, it was like that.
Yes.
That's the story of this movie, you know?
Because obviously Sarah Michelle Gellar is in the movie. She's very, very funny in the film. And Adam, this blew my mind when I discovered this. You officiated her wedding.
I did. That was one of the easier phone calls for me to make. I have a very long relationship with Sarah Michelle and her husband and Freddie Prinze. And yes, I officiated their wedding.
That's amazing. Now,
by the way, it wasn't until like last year that we were together at something and I said, you know, I've never asked you, why the hell did you ask me to officiate your wedding? Of all of things like that. And I'm not going to tell the story about why, but but the story made sense to me. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. I adore those two. They are old, wonderful friends of mine. And I'm so proud that the one wedding I've officiated has, you know, produced, ended in a lasting marriage that couldn't be more strong to this day.
So that's the one wedding, because that was my next question. Have you officiated any other weddings? Are you available to officiate?
I am available. It's my side hustle.
And was this power bestowed upon you by the internet or what, how did that happen?
100% by the internet. It's just so brilliant to me that like for $20 and an application, I can decide, I can legally decide that people are married. I can ordain it and I, you know, create a lifelong marriage. It's so weird. But God bless it, you know?
Does that play into the idea that you can do that? Does that play into the God complex that I suspect all directors have to some extent?
100%. We all think we're God. What are you talking about? are you implying that we're not? You know, it's so funny. I've worked with so many directors before I was directing.
Yeah.
I worked with, you know, I worked on well over 100 movies and with so many directors and so many great directors and some less great directors. And it's the great ones that have zero God complex. And it's the not great ones that seem to have the bigger God complex. And when I say great, I'm not even talking about the work that they produce is great. I'm talking about how they are at work, on set, in the environment, doing that, you know, how they treat crew, how you behave in your safe space.
Is that something that's run through your career, you know, as director all the way from The Wedding Planner onwards, you know, like you know, the way you hold yourself, the way you comport yourself on set is so important?
It's really important to me. It's really important to me because I'm from crew. Like I started when I was dancing and stuff. And then when I became a choreographer and I worked on all those movies and all those TV sets, It's very difficult to learn something from somebody who's great at what they do, because it seems like some sort of magic trick that they're, you know, because it so much of what makes a great director, it's sort of just instinctual and inside their head, and you can't get a handle on that. Yeah. It's the shitty ones that I learned everything from, because I was like, you are exactly what I don't want to be. These, watching you make these decisions, watching you being incapable of making a decision, watching the way that you treat a crew member, watching the way that you do, like, those became the easiest ways for me to really learn about how I wanted to comport myself, and also and be a leader in some way, because it's, you know, being a director is a very isolating job. It's like, you're the only one on any given set, unless you are a team of directors, you know, and you are, you know, at least while you're shooting, basically the final word. And it's all predicated on, you know, how you're telling any given story that you're working on. And I take that very, very seriously, because it is a very happy, safe space. And it is also the only space where I know exactly what my purpose is. It's like, when I call cut and it's a wrap and I go home, I have no fucking idea what I'm supposed to do. Like, I have, like, I'm a disaster. Like, I don't know what my purpose is other than to take care of my dogs and to make sure that my friends and family know I'm alive and that I'm being a good son or, you know, friend or boyfriend or like whatever it is. And so it's the most purpose-filled I ever feel. So I take that as like a holy space for me. And so to be a jerk in that space would be counterproductive, and it would make my life miserable. And I don't do this to be miserable. I do this to be happy, you know? So it's the only thing I really know how to do other than bake. So...
Well, you know, baking's very lucrative these days, Adam, but...
Kind of, right? Another side hustle. Like, believe me, I have friends who are like, no, we should start a little something here.
You could do the whole thing. You could officiate the wedding. You could shoot the wedding video. You could bake the wedding cake. I'm saying that this is perhaps...
I'm terrible at cakes. I'm great at cookies, cupcakes, cheesecakes. I'm brilliant at. I can't make a normal cake to save my life because I can't figure out how to frost them. Like, I make great frosting, but I can't figure out how to stack a cake and frost it exactly. I don't know why. Oh, I'm sure I could learn, but...
Yeah, maybe one day you'll crack that code. Who knows? But I've got to go in a second. But as you mentioned at the beginning, this is the first of your two films out this year. You're remarkably prolific in 2026. The Man with the Bag. Arnold Schwarzenegger as Santa Claus, which is something I can't believe hasn't happened.
I sort of, after day one of shooting him, I was like, how has this never happened before? Like, I'm going to step 30,000 feet outside of my own life and my own career. And I'm just telling you objectively, I swear to God, he is so freaking good in this movie. It's crazy. Like, I was like, oh my God, who knew that Santa Claus was the role Arnold Schwarzenegger was born to play? It's so crazy. It's him and Alan Ritchson and Awkwafina and Ka Mooney and Eliza Koshy and Michael Cyril Creighton. It's just such an incredible group of people. And it's a lovely film. It really is a lovely film. I'm actually proud of it. So
I'm excited to talk to you about that again whenever Christmas comes around. We can chat about The Man with the Bag as well, because you have this knack throughout your career of taking these A-list actors and doing stuff that kind of obviously plays into our image a little bit, but also subverts it and plays against it, whether it's Tom Cruise in Rock of Ages or Vin Diesel in The Pacifier. You know, it's all there.
Yeah, and for some reason with me, it's always the dudes. It's like, I don't know why. It's like, I haven't done as much time with the ladies, and I'd like to correct that a little bit. But I've had a great successful and love. I have great relationships with all of them. I adore them. I'm stunned that we've gotten to do the things together that we've gotten to do. And I don't take it for granted, and I really appreciate it. And by the way, not to try to circle back to stop that train, but it's like, to work with these queens in this and put them in the front and center of this insane project, and to have them fill the space in the way that they did and to be so good is just a great source of pride for me.
Absolutely. But if I can just correct you very, very quickly on your pronunciation, it's Stop That Train.
It is. I'm sorry. Sometimes I slur. It's a speech impediment. I apologize. Thanks for pointing it out. Whatever.
Don't worry. I'll fix it in post. It's all good. On that note, Adam Shankman, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for taking the time.
All right. That was Adam Shankman, folks. And Stop That Train is now out in cinemas and is a right old lark. Fans of RuPaul's Drag Race will love it. And speaking of RuPaul's Drag Race, Ginger Minj and Jujubee, the film stars, will be on the next episode of The Interviews. And trust me, they were a ton of fun. One last interview now, and it is with the star of the latest Insidious movie, subtitled Stop That Demon! No, it's actually Insidious Out of the Further, the sixth installment of the wildly successful horror franchise. And as the title suggests, this time the demons of the Further are going further than they've ever gone before. And they're led by the chilling Cyrus, played by the wonderful British character actor Sam Spruill, who's been so memorable in the likes of Fargo Season 5 and Legend. He's got something of a penchant for memorable miscreants, but thankfully, he's a lovely bloke in real life, as we discovered when Becky Dark, making her interview debut on the Empire podcast, chatted to him on Zoom just the other day. Here it is, as they dive into the process of creating a truly bad guy. Enjoy.
Sam Spruill, welcome to the Empire podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you, yes.
Good. I was sat in a beautifully air-conditioned screening room this morning watching Insidious Out of the Further today, and I had such a good time with it, Sam. It was great to be back with Elise and all her spooky enemies, of which you are now one. So can you tell me a little bit about your new big bad, this kind of entity that you play out of the Further?
Yeah, I mean, he is like, he's another kind of demon from the Further, another kind of spirit villain, if you like. And and I suppose when I first came across it, I met the director, Jacob Chase, to talk about playing Cyrus.
Yeah.
In the film. And he pitched it to me as this kind of, kind of powerful figure who had been killed in the 70s, who has kind of retained his power and his charm and charisma, if you like, in the Further, and wants to bring himself along with his followers back to the real world. And I just thought, this sounds so great. And the way he pitched what he wanted to do with the film, it all sounded so creative and interesting. And Jacob Chase, who directed it, is a man full of ideas. And I'm an actor who loves to work with people who are full of ideas, who are kind of full of creativity, because that's how I'm like, full of ideas. I'm full of creativity and kind of the world of horror really has the capacity to hold that, that level.
For sure.
Tension, I think. And before we did all the scenes that we worked on together, we had lots of great chats about character and the world and costume and how we were going to do certain things. And it really kind of played out as a very creative experience.
I love that. Yeah, the character design really stuck out to me. Actually, you've got this, you said there about Cyrus having been killed in the 70s, and he's this kind of cult leader figure. You kind of get that through a sort of flashback through an old sort of videotape or some sort of spectral TV broadcast. But he's kind of retained that. He's got the long hair, the kind of robes, rings on his fingers. But one of the things that really stuck out to me was kind of the blindfold as well. Like, that was quite striking as part of the kind of look. So, yeah, how did the kind of the character design itself sort of help you kind of bring the character to life?
I mean, it's all kind of develops as you're going on in this conversation. Mm. But just to start kind of, you know, I did early on, obviously, I knew that he was a kind of cult leader. So, and he died, and he was alive in the 70s. And so, you know, let's go for some flowing robes. Let's go for sandals. Let's go for long hair. Do all that kind of, really lean into that tropey American cult leader.
Yeah.
And, you know, like a kind of horrible hippie, well, vicious, brutal, murderous hippie. And that kind of, that felt great. And then we built into, you know, he wanted a specific color, which was really good. And then Jacob really had these strong ideas that he wanted trinkets kind of around Cyrus's neck from all the kind of from all his victims. So there was rings, there was a retainer hanging off at one point, and just different things, and which kind of created this horrible kind of montage hanging around his neck of visual disgustingness. And then also kind of, then you had the great kind of, he's been the further a long time, so he's degraded and diminished, and his nails are horrible, and his body's kind of peeling away and being, and kind of, and just disgusting, you know? And that's like, it's great. It's great. Cause you, as a kind of actor, you just want to kind of let rip, and suddenly you're being given kind of absolute license to do so in so many ways. And then, you know, the blindfold came quite late in the process, but what was so good about it was that, I don't know, you're trying to create a kind of image, a strong image, and a kind of, and a strong kind of tone about this character. So to have him kind of feeling his way through the dark, felt, you know, and obviously the blindfold comes from a set piece that you kind of get a glimpse of that occurs in the 70s when he's alive. But yeah, you to have this as him in the further stuck with this blindfold.
Yeah, it almost looks, it was interesting what you were saying about him having been in there for so long, because it almost looks as if it's like become part of his face. He's not wearing it, it's like part of him.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of forged itself to his skin.
Yeah.
It's
all,
and so, you know, again, that was all part of the discussions that you can have when you're doing a horror film. And I mean, I was like, what have I been doing all my career? Because this is the first horror film that I've done. And I was like, these are my people. This is kind of my world. And I love, you know, I've played a lot of strong characters in my life, and so you know, this was another one where you could really, as I say, let rip. So the whole creation around him was just such fun, and like what costume did, and then makeup with my body, and the kind of the quality of his hair is so disgusting, and I loved it. And it just kept going. Like, yeah, you can see my toenails through the sandals. Let's make them horrible. You know, I mean, it was just everything. We just went to town. It was, and it's great. And actually, there's probably a lot more material than made it into the film. You know, that's just the nature of filmmaking. You've got so many characters to kind of hold in it. But I think there's definitely a kind of spin-off available for Cyrus to kind of go out into the world again. So
I'd love that. I'd love to go back and revisit him in the 70s, maybe, like do a period piece.
Yeah. What's that when they call it a, you know, when you, it's his,
His origin story.
His origin story. Yes. Exactly. That's what we need.
You said that you obviously haven't done a kind of horror movie before in terms of being in one, but how was it to kind of join a big popular horror franchise like Insidious at this stage? Were you already a fan? Did you have to do much preparation in terms of watching all the previous movies?
I watched one with my son and really enjoyed it, but I didn't really know about it.
Right.
And I, just because I suppose I'm not, like, I haven't seen loads of horror, and certainly modern horror has kind of escaped me.
Right.
partly because my focus, I guess, is on other stuff, other types of cinema. But I've always wanted to do a horror film, and now I'm like, I'm fully there, and definitely got the bug. But it's kind of I didn't really need to. I really learned different aspects of the world, how the world works, the different characters that have emerged through the franchise. You know, I was really obviously knew about Lynn Shay. Fantastic, you know, love the fact that she's the baseline to this whole world, and that's great. But my reference, I guess, was kind of powerful people who are who behave very badly, and you know, there's lots of those kind of people in the real world in which we live. So I just picked a few of those horrors and kind of thought about them and how I wanted to transpose their spirit into Cyrus, you know.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the normal things, like there's certain things that you retain in your head where you've been really scared yourself in certain films with certain characters that you go back and revisit. And that is always part of my process. Like I often put, you know, when I start working on a character, I put a visual mood board together. Lots of people do that. So you can have a kind of, you can cross-reference with your director and just kind of, forms the beginning of a discussion. And so, yeah, I had a few proper nasties in there, which I kind of don't want to reveal because I don't want to kind of take the attention away from Cyrus. But yeah, some proper nasties, both from the real world and both from the kind of films that I had seen in the past.
I think there was something about him, just going back to the cult leader thing, about bringing that aspect into obviously like a supernatural franchise like Insidious. There's something about the kind of, I don't know, the phenomenon of the cult leader in 2026, which I thought really meshed so well with kind of what we've seen from the franchise before, but seems to chime maybe louder than ever before in terms of the world that we're living in now. So it's interesting to hear that you were kind of drawing on that.
Yeah, we're living in a world of personality, aren't we?
Yeah.
And where the style purports to be one thing, but the substance is actually quite different. And yeah. I suppose, you know, that does chime with Cyrus and chimes with a lot of people who are coming into your mind right now that we don't need to discuss. But
exactly. Kind
of, you know, we are not short of kind of frightening people in the real world. And so yeah, I had them all over my mood board and they were very good to kind of reference in my head, maybe before I do a scene or whatever.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
Then also, then you're just on set as well and you're just opposite good actors who are giving you a whole kind of different perspective on the scene. And there's nothing like, you can plan as much as you like, but once you get there, once you get to set, once you see how it all kind of plays out, once you have to kind of collaborate with actors who have totally different ideas of how it should be, you know, then it becomes something different and you have to kind of throw away a lot of what you've thought about just to kind of live in that moment. But
yeah, of course.
Hopefully you've done enough prep where some of what you've decided stays in that character, stays in your delivery, stays in your presentation, you know.
Part of the presentation from you, Sam, is that he's got such a quite idiosyncratic voice. And I thought that the sound design on the film as well, like it felt like Cyrus's voice was just booming in my ears every time you were kind of on screen or his like disembodied voice came over.
Good. I love that.
Oh, good. But did you do, I mean, I know that your character in the Fargo TV show also had a very sort of idiosyncratic voice and way of speaking. And then obviously Cyrus has got that kind of very sort of deep, menacing kind of way of speaking. And that voice is that, as I say, sort of booms through the sound design. So were you able to kind of pull on anything from sort of Old Monk in terms of, you know, the vocals or even just the bad guy stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I've played a lot of bad guys. Yeah. So, you know, maybe that kind of, I just have access to that. You know, some people have access to kind of being romantic. I hope that doesn't escape me, mind. But, you know, some people have access to that or can cry or whatever. I have access to kind of being menacing. Maybe I grew up with a lot of rotters in Southeast London, or, you know, I don't know what allows you that, what gives you that, but it just, but that's been part of my journey, a significant part of it.
Yeah.
But they're all different. You will try and kind of make it different. And you also, I suppose, you know, there's two different things. The psychology, and then the voice is kind of was real experimentation, because actually we also thought about how the further had affected his voice. So actually when he's alive in the 70s, he's got a kind of higher pitched voice.
I noticed kind of that, yeah.
Then we take him through, you know, and he's just, you know, folded into himself. He's just he's become a thicker liquid, if you like, you know, so we try to kind of do that in the voice, and actually we did different things where we recorded some of my voice and then layered it with another voice that I had done, you know, and there was experimentation there. Like, I don't know what I've only seen the film once, so I couldn't just totally see what they had done, but it's all my voice. It's all kind of, there's no effects on there. I think part of Jacob Chase's filmmaking is actually he wants as little effects as possible. So from the sound design to the visual, what you see, he's a real practical filmmaker, you know, and he began life actually creating immersive live theatrical shows. And
interesting.
Yeah, no, and he really brings that into his filmmaking, and kind of, so sometimes you turn up on set and there would be you'd be doing a scene with lots of people working the scenery to give a certain effect, whether it be doors closing, curtains blowing, anything that he just didn't want to rely on CGI. He wanted it people kind of making those things move and work in camera on the day. And that felt like old school filmmaking, you know, and I really loved it. You know, and you've got a much bigger team as a result on set or in the room that you're acting in, kind of doing stuff. But it's like you're all working together. It's very exciting when it comes off.
You mentioned Lynn Shay just now, and I think if you really know, if you know that a bad guy is really bad, you know that you have to get Lynn Shay back in to deal with him. How was it? Yeah. How was it working with her, this horror icon?
Yeah, she's a horror icon. I totally learned that. She's kind of she's a proper actress as well. You know, that's nice for me. Someone who's been doing it, I don't know, maybe 60 years, and turning up to work on time, energized. She's really good in the film. Her voice is really strong. Physically, she's still so there, you know, in quite a kind of frenetic series of events that she's a part of. And so I actually loved working with her. And the great thing about actors, you know, is that they're really... they're enthusiastic till the end, I've found, predominantly. And she's definitely one of those, you know, and I just thought she was great.
I love it. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Sam. But thank you so much for joining me today and chatting to me about this film. As I say, I had a great time, scared the bejesus out of me. And a lot of that was down to you. So thank you very much.
Oh, that's so great to hear. Very nice to meet you.
Thanks.
And that was Becky Dark talking to Sam Spruill. And thanks to Sam for taking time out of his holiday. I think he was in Crete. Not the further, That would have been crazy to have that chat with us. So it's very much appreciated. Insidious Out of the Further is in cinemas now, both here and in the Further, which is nice. And on that note, that's it for this episode of The Interviews. Hope you enjoyed it. There'll be another one in a few days' time. And meanwhile, the Main Empire podcast is up, up, up right now with Helen O'Hara, James Dyer and Jamie Graham and Harry Stainer talking to Shane Schoenbrunn about their new movie, Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma. And a spoiler special for that, also with an interview with Shane Schoenbrunn, is going to be up very, very soon behind the Empire Plus paywall. How exciting. As ever, thanks for listening and supporting the podcast. And if you haven't got your tickets yet for our live show at King's Place on Saturday, September 5th, just a couple of weeks away now, go to kingsplace.co.uk and snap up what's left. Maybe buy them all. I don't know. I'm not the boss of you. But anyway, on that note, that is enough for me. I'm off to close the door on the Further forever, or until they make Insidious 7. One of the two. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.